Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
When Aristotle tackles the subject in the first book of his Ethics, the Greek philosopher, he becomes more technical, more rigorous, more with a methodology in talking about happiness. One of his important statements is, "Now we call that object, which is desired for its own sake, more perfect than one that is desired for some further purpose." It's in the sense that I don't buy a dream house, or I'll buy a dream house in order to be happy, okay? I'll get married in order to be happy. It doesn't happen in reverse, okay? I'll be happy then I'll buy other things, I'll add things onto that, okay? It has the nature of a final end. It has the nature of a fundamental desire. It has a sense of ultimacy about it. Then when we're seeking happiness, we may seek it through other things, through material things, through pleasures, other things. But at the bottom or at the end of the road, we're seeking happiness. We're seeking that basic thing. Happiness, he goes on, in fact, seems especially to be of this nature, for we choose it in every case for itself and never for something else. Okay, there's a finality, again, ultimacy to it. For itself, it's chosen for itself, unlike other desires, a job, marriage, you know, to be happy, you know, to go somewhere else. He also says that happiness, without further addition, will be the most desirable. Okay, preferable is probably another translation there. Desirable of all things. It also attracts us. It also calls us. It also beckons us in some way. So Aristotle is getting a little more technical when he's talking about happiness. And the technical word he uses in Greek is eudaimonia. And the origins of that word, which we can translate as happiness, we look at some other translations now, is that it meant being fortunate. It meant being lucky. You have a guardian spirit, a daimon, who favors you and brings you luck. So kind of an ancient Greek version of a leprechaun, okay? Or a lucky charm. Or you see it in literature as well, the girl with auburn hair brings me luck. You know, these things, you know. But in the Greek classical sense, it was the daimon who you know, granted this fortune, this look. Now, Aristotle is building on that. He wants to go further than just seeing happiness or eudaimonia as look. But he admitted that many of his contemporaries saw good look and eudaimonia as being the same thing. Somehow, you're happy because you've been fortunate, okay? You're blessed with things, good things. Things have fallen into place for you. You're happy. Now, Aristotle doesn't completely divorce eudaimonia from fortune or goods of fortune. But he just wants to go further. He wants to transcend that. He wants to give us a reasonable approach to what it is to be happy. Oh, I forgot to say, yeah. So even the word that we have today, our happy English language, it's a sense of having hap, you know, things are haphazard. They happened. It just happened to happen. Or I was hapless in my studies. I was hapless in training. I had no luck. Okay, so fortune. Perhaps it will happen. It may not. Perhaps. My hap, you know, in that sense. So even happy, our English word today, does have that sense as well. It continues on from the Greek sense. So the different translations of eudaimonia are happiness, as we've seen. Another would be human flourishing, or just flourishing by itself. Doing well or living well, you could say, or fulfillment. It's always more or less an activity. It's something you do. It's something you're perhaps capable of. Some of the other features that Aristotle works out, not all of them. First of all, he says that it will also be common to human nature. Happiness can be had by all. So we're all capable as human beings of happiness, of reaching that condition and that end, that place, however you want to put it. He also says that eudaimonia is the best, therefore, the noblest and most pleasurable of all things. In a funny way, happiness is something objective. It has an objective character. It's a state, you could say, shared or something in common. It's always the best. It's the noblest. It has desire and pleasure, you know, that come with it. But it's not just my own subjectivity. We can be mistaken about happiness. I may think myself happy, but I may not be happy. Okay, that's the idea. So it has a kind of a sense of transcending even the individual human being as well. The other thing you have to note in Aristotle's understanding of happiness is that he still thinks it's kind of borderline, you know. It's a human activity, but it's also, you could say, it has something to do with divinity. It's something bestowed. It's something given by the gods, you could say. So there's a divine attachment or a divine association with it. And even to be happy, he says, is something divine. No matter where we see its source from, it has something of divinity in it. Doesn't expound on that too much, I don't think, but he has a high, lofty understanding of it. It's probably what makes him such a good philosopher as well. The last thing I'll say here from Aristotle is that he says it must extend to a complete life. Okay, so it's not flitting. It's not a day's happiness. It's not a few hours of bliss. No, it's consistent. It's abiding. It's remaining. It becomes a criteria of one's life. It becomes a way of living, you could say. It becomes a kind of activity. Or he says, a short practice of virtue. Okay, so it's very much to do with virtue, which is living well, living human excellences in the moral field and in the intellectual field. So happiness has to do with all this. It's kind of bringing them all together. It's the fulfilling of what you can be. It's the best you can be capable of. It's the exercise of your highest faculty, which is your mind, towards the highest object, which is the consideration for Aristotle of, you know, philosophical things, contemplation of truth, truth itself, the God, you know, such things. So the philosopher, for Aristotle, you know, has access to this life. He can enter, or he can acquire this state of happiness, this condition of happiness. He'll also have some friends with him as well, to discuss philosophy, to walk, to converse, to eat well, you know, to do things well. So it's caught up with a life of excellence. Again, a life of flourishing, a life of doing well. And it's completely disworldly. It's completely earthly. Okay, it's not so much transcending this world. So that's Aristotle, a bit more systematic when he talks about eudaimonia and happiness, probably than more so than his predecessors. But there is another tradition among the Greeks when we talk about happiness, that happiness is something transcendent. Happiness is something beyond the remit of what we ordinarily experience. Okay, you get it in Plato's Symposium. But if we're given to man to gaze on beauty's very self, unsullied, unalloyed, to see the heavenly beauty face to face. So to pass through a veil, to go higher than we can normally experience. Okay, to experience goodness, to experience the fount of goodness or the form of goodness, more than an earthly experience. So a different kind of approach to Aristotle. By the time we get to St. Thomas Aquinas, he is able to embrace both the earthly and the heavenly, you could say. He says that happiness is twofold, one perfect, the other imperfect. And by perfect happiness, we are to understand that which attains to the true nature of happiness. Okay, it'll be beyond everyday experience. It'll be beyond our earthly remit, where we are now. We can't attain it just right now, but we're on that journey. We're on that destination as such. Imperfect happiness, even Aristotle admitted that he's conception of eudaimonia was imperfect. That kind of happiness he was proposing as the best life, life with excellence in it, was imperfect. And Thomas says that imperfect happiness partakes of some particular likeness of happiness. It has some participation, you could say, in happiness. It's on the way, it's a foreshadowing. It's a foreboding, or you know, something like that. Something that is an anticipation of true and perfect happiness. So I'm just going to leave that aside for the moment, and I'm going to talk about what St. Thomas deals with when he talks about, like, it's called them candidates for happiness. Okay, he wants to talk about perfect happiness, but he does a kind of a detour. Okay, he brings us out what we ordinarily may put as a candidate for happiness. You know, what we see our final end in, what we see our basic desire for, how we'll be fulfilled. The first one he deals with is wealth, money, success, I suppose, material success in some way. He says this is different to the sovereign good, okay, the highest good, okay. He says the more perfect the sovereign good is possessed, the more it is loved and other things despised. It's like a magnet drawing us in, and we can't get enough of the sovereign good, okay, the highest good, which gives us perfect happiness. He does a little psychological analysis then, you could say, of how we deal with temporal goods or with material things. He says it's different with material things. It's kind of reverse direction. For when we already possess them, we despise them. And we seek others. It's like when you look at yesterday's wardrobe, your old clothes or your old car or your old phone. You loved it in the first weeks, but you tire very quickly of them. Very finite, very unsatisfying over a long term situation. That's the rhythm, you could say. That's the sequence. We acquire material things. They delight us for a while. We grow tired of them. We hate them. And we go looking for others. I remember in my family, one of my uncles, lovely uncle, lovely man, but he'd buy a new car. And he bought the best cars, really good cars. But after a while, he'd get tired of it. He'd get a new one. And Thomas uses scripture just to give us a sense of this. He says, this is the sense of whoever drinks of this water by which temporal goods are signified shall thirst again. So there's money satisfied, or there's material things satisfied for a short time. There is a thrill, you know, there is a delight. There is a kind of happiness in getting a good bargain and getting something you like. And that's generally our experience, but it doesn't last. Perhaps more subtle, search for honours. Honour is a sign of excellence. Okay, you're the top student, you're the top athlete, you're a grade A athlete, you're a super singer, all these things. We honour people as a testament to their excellence. Okay, in Ireland, we honor top hurlers and, you know, top sportsmen, you know, things like that, you know. So it's external to us. We're dependent on that kind of public recognition. But Thomas says, happiness is in the happy. It's not external to us. But honour is not in the honoured, but rather in him who honours and who offers deference to the person honoured. So that's one of his arguments, okay, that it's external. And happiness is not external, okay, because we see it'll be more internal than we even imagine. He also argues that virtue is the good life, its true reward is happiness itself, for which the virtuous work, those who live good lives. Whereas if they work for honour, it would no longer be a virtue, but ambition. So for St. Thomas, ambition is a vice which has an inordinate, let's say disordered desire for honour. Okay, if it makes honour a principal aim, it's indication that a vice, a vicious way of acting, is present in someone's character. So honours, they don't qualify as, you know, as this search for happiness, the search for the ultimate, for some of these reasons. Another one, we live in a culture of celebrity and fame, so it keeps coming up in a sense. So for St. Thomas, glory consists in being well known and praised. Is it a candidate for happiness? Perhaps in some sense, in some sense. But he says human glory is frequently deceptive. Public opinion is easily misled, okay, about fame, about qualities persons have, okay, who are known publicly. So he's careful, he's hesitant. He says, happiness is man's true good, but it happens that many owe their renown to the lying reports spread among the people. Well, it's actually rumors, okay? Lying rumors spread among the people. So it can be false. He says, fame, it seems to be closely attached to glory. Fame has no stability. In fact, it is easily ruined by a false rumor. So it doesn't have consistency. It doesn't have an abiding sense. It's very vulnerable. It's very fragile. And it may not be based on a true foundation at the same time. It's kind of like out there in the atmosphere, in the public realm. And it may not be, you know, a testament to something that's true, a true quality, or a true testament to someone's, say, excellence or what they can do. He says then that happiness endures of itself and forever. Okay, so it is enduring. It is consistent. Of course, he's talking about perfect happiness. So he shoots down, he's shooting down the different candidates as he goes along and giving his reasons. I'm sure we can think of other reasons. And sometimes they tap into our own experience as well. Okay, maybe even what happens today in, you know, the newspaper world or the social media world, or all the platforms. And we can see that, you know, glory, fame is very fragile. Power. Power is attractive. It's another candidate. You do have to deal with power if you want to talk about happiness. Because people are attracted by power. They can give, you know, a whole life to being in power. So he says, people who are in power seem, on the account of the similarity of power, to be most like to God. So a God-like quality in some sense attached to those who are powerful, who are in control, perhaps who dominate, who probably have superior skills at some things, or have got into that position because of some giftedness as well. He also says, more than anything else, human beings shun servitude. Don't always like being bottom of the pile or, running around. Like my job when I became chaplain in Trinity was the unglamorous work of doing the shopping on Tuesdays for its soup. It's unglamorous, but it's the bottom of the pile. I was last in. The last person in gets the milk, okay, in any jobs, you know, that sense. So we don't always like that. Not that I actually mind at all, but he says power is most imperfect. It cannot relieve the gnawings of care, nor can it avoid the thorny path of anxiety. When I was a student one time, I lived in Tala, or St. Mary's Priory. I remember a man coming to our door with no peace, no, completely restless, greatly huge anxiety. And we dealt with him kindly that night, and he'd come. And turned out after he was kind of a boss over 1,200 people in a computer firm, something like that. Just the anxiety, the care, and the pressure that he was under. And we had to ring his wife at the end of the night, and she said, yeah, sometimes he gets like this. He just wanted to come in and get some break from all that, you know. So that's an everyday experience as well, or, you know, a common experience. The other thing that Thomas says is that the one who is powerful can sometimes inspire fear in those who serve him or her, but he fears his attendants he fears them still more. You go through the history of dictatorships, you see that all the time. You see it in Shakespeare. Julius Caesar says in Shakespeare, you know, under in Shakespeare's pen, young Cassius, no, let me have men around me that are fat, sleek-headed men that sleep o' nights. Young Cassius has a lean and hungry look. He thinks too much. Such men are dangerous. So he's looking at his potential conspirator. He's not secure in the power, in the control, in the position that he has. And that repeats itself in history. Great literature can lead us into things like that. So that's what Thomas is saying as well. That's how he's analysing power and its effect, and why it doesn't qualify, as a perfect form of happiness. Pleasure might seem simple, but pleasure can be very attractive. Is pleasure happiness for Epicureans, for Epicurean philosophy? Yes, it is the highest good. There's a long historical and philosophical kind of project or understanding that pleasure is the highest good. Okay, but Thomas doesn't agree with that. He says very kind of bluntly, he says, anyone that chooses to look back on his past excesses will perceive that pleasures have a sad ending. And notice he is saying excesses here. He's not anti-pleasure. Pleasure is actually the sign of a perfection of an activity. When you're doing something well, whether it's riding a bike or playing classical flute, you have pleasure that attends that or accompanies that playing. Okay, because it's a perfection of an activity. When we do things well, we have pleasure. He's not saying that. He's talking about, I suppose, bodily pleasures here, in a sense. He says, the good which is fitting to the body and which causes bodily delight is not man's perfect good, but is quite a trifle compared to the good of the soul. The soul is capable of an infinite good, of a transcendent good, of a good that's, everlasting for the moment. Whereas the body is caught up with finite things, finite goods, positioned things, determined things. So it doesn't really compare with what the soul is capable of impressing upon itself, what it's capable of enjoying, what it's capable of expanding to. And then I found this on the internet. It is St. Thomas, but I can't find any reference, but it's quoted all over the internet, and I'm sure it's him, but he says, man cannot live without joy. Therefore, when he is deprived of true spiritual joys, it is necessary that he become addicted to carnal pleasures. Okay, so we can capitulate to pleasures. It doesn't enjoy a high place in the hierarchy of human satisfactions. It is satisfying in some sense, but it may be a sign of a lack of something else, of a true interiority, or a fall from virtue, or whatever it may be. Okay, so let's talk about God. Okay. Probably understand that's where I'm reaching for, that's where Thomas is bringing us, in philosophical language, in technical language as well. So by nature, by its own natural power, we can know that God exists. Okay, we can form an argument, it's a first cause, there's an unmoved mover. There's a being that gives being to others, in that sense. We can contemplate his attributes through the veil or mirror of creation. We can see that creation, nature, is wisely and intelligently ordered. We can start there and deduce back that it comes from an author who is wise, orderly, and intelligent. Okay, we use arguments like that, philosophical arguments, using our reason. Okay, so we can see the intelligible effects. We can see the effects coming from a cause somewhere. And we can reason from the effects that there is some kind of cause that maybe it resembles the effects somewhere. Okay. Or the effects resemble the cause. But our natural powers of intellect and will, we'll say, we cannot see God as he is. Okay. I can see this as it is, okay? This bottle of river rock water. Okay. I know what it is. I know what the thing is. I know its essence. That's what the intellect, the object of the intellect is what a thing is, the essence of it. I can't do that naturally with God. I can't point out God to you. I can, that's the essence. There it is. There's God, and that's what it looks like, okay? My intellect is kind of fuzzy. I may enjoy God, I may look towards God, I may have faith in God, for example, okay? But naturally, a little better if you want to have faith, but naturally I don't see God's essence. I see the effects of the cause. Yeah, I give an example that Thomas gives himself, a nice one. Knowing the eclipse of the sun, we see this effect, this beautiful luminous effect of the sun eclipsing. And we wonder, we have admiratio. So admiration or wonder emerges from effects whose causes are unknown. We wonder at the effect, we admire it, and we begin to inquire about what is the cause of this. It's the beginning of philosophical inquiry. Admiratio, admiring, looking at, seeing a certain beauty, seeing a certain admirable quality in what it is. And that's what we're doing with our intellects. That's what we're doing, our minds are doing, you know, incessantly. We're looking at things. We're looking for more. We're looking for the essence. But naturally, we can't get there. Okay, we can't see. I can't point out God to you. For St. Thomas, okay, complete happiness. And he uses another word, another technical word, beatitudo, different from Aristotle, requires the mind to come true to the essence itself of the first cause. And so it will have its fulfillment by union with God as its object. Okay, so you're going beyond the effect. You're getting to the cause, the first cause, okay, the primary cause, which the human mind searches for. We have that capability to search, you know, for causes, to be drawn by things we admire. So it's very scholastic language, beatitudo. Beatitude is a perfection of happiness. Okay, it's perfect happiness. It's not just happiness. It's not just ordinary happiness or, you know, common happiness. It's the perfection. It's the highest reach of happiness. When we contemplate the highest object, when we see that object, when we reach that object with our mind. Okay. Pope Benedict's a very good writer, so I thought he'd be good for just kind of fleshing it out a small bit. You know, what is that like? It's something more like the supreme moment of satisfaction. It would be like plunging into the ocean of infinite love, a moment in which time, the before and after, no longer exists. It's more colourful, okay? It's more dynamic in a sense. It's what St. Thomas is saying, okay, in the scholastic language that he uses, which is very technical and very precise as well. Essence, first cause, object, fulfilment, happiness, beatitudo. So it's a loaded sentence, probably one of the best sentences in this whole treatise on happiness that he has in the early part of the Summa, of the second part of the Summa. St. Teresa of Jesus, again, gives a sense of the personal, the loving, the intimate nature of this dream. that the more you struggle, the more you prove the love that you bear your God, and the more you will rejoice one day with your beloved in a happiness and rapture that can never end. Okay, so the lover and the beloved meet. Okay, they're eternally matched. They eternally, embrace in that sense. This is beatitude, which is the perfection of happiness in the Christian perspective and from the perspective of St. Thomas. So I'm going to talk about a little bit more about that, what it includes, what constitutes this as well before we finish. So for him, happiness, it's beatitudo, is man's proper and perfect good. Okay, it's proper to us, not proper to animals, not in the same way. It's proper because it depends on our ability to know, our intellects. So it's proper to us, to human beings, and a perfect good, okay? The highest good, the sovereign good, the final good, the supreme good. It is incompatible with any evil. So there's no evil, there's no anxiety, there's no care, there's nothing vulnerable about this happiness. Okay, it's unchanging. It's not spotted in any way, or it's not blemished in any way. It is the nature of happiness to satisfy of itself. Okay, going back to Aristotle, he also says this, happiness is kind of satisfying. It has a self-sufficiency, he talks. Having gained it, we cannot lack any needful good. We will not say with beatitudo, I need more. There is something lacking to me. There's something I still don't have. We'll never sing that song. The song, was it, I can get no satisfaction. We can't sing that in heaven. It makes no sense. Okay. What happens to our appetite, our loving, affective part of our nature, our will? It lulls the appetite altogether. Else it would not be the last end. So there's the perfect repose of your will, of your loving powers in the divine object, in seeing God himself, seeing the essence of it, seeing who God is, not just effects or created things or true sacraments or mediated things. We see God face to face. We intuit directly who God is. We know now this is God. I know God. I'm not knowing about God. I actually know God. I see God. I can delineate. I can point out God to you. I've met God. Okay. So it's not much higher kind of knowledge than we presently experience of the divine. He says that happiness does not consist in a bodily good as its object, but bodily good can add a certain charm and perfection to happiness. So for St. Thomas and the Thomist tradition, the vision of God is primarily intellectual. Okay, the substance of it, or the essence of it, or what it is my mind reaching the essence of the first cause. Okay, my intellect knows the first cause, sees the first cause, understands in some, not completely, understands in some way the first cause. But I will have a body in heaven. Okay, and for Thomas, the psychology is that the bodily, our bodily being will receive an overflow of the blessedness, of the happiness that we receive from God. Okay, overflow, will redound to the body as well. So the glory we receive, the happiness, will also be present in some way in our bodies. But the body is secondary. It's principally about the mind, about our highest faculty, our highest power, to meet the highest object, who is God. Is that okay? Okay, just one or two more slides. Interesting, just one kind of additional thing just to say about where we're going with this. Aristotle says, and St. Thomas would agree with him, in the happiness of this life, the happy person needs friends, as the philosopher says, that he may do good to them, that he may delight in seeing them do good, and again, that he may be helped by them in his good work. So in this life, friends are necessary. They're, you know, they constitute in some way our happiness. They're part of us. We depend on them. We're social beings. We're social animals in that sense, and in various ways, as you would know yourself, right? Is it good for us? It's different in the heavenly life or before the vision of God. This might surprise you a little bit. In perfect happiness, the fellowship of friends is not essential to happiness. If you are the one and only soul enjoying God in heaven before the beatific vision, before the divine object, let's say, you'd be perfectly happy, even without your body. Okay? So friends are not essential to that happiness. We can have happiness without them. But he says, it conduces, friendship, the fellowship of friends, conduces to the well-being of happiness. It's not incompatible with it. And he goes back to Augustine just to talk about it. And Augustine, again, is precise. He says, they receive no other interior aid. Okay, so the friend is not helping you in an inner way to be more happy, because everything is concentrated on God. God is primary. He has priority. Everything is centered on God. Everything you receive from God is enough. God alone satisfies, Thomas says, okay? So we can't do, like we hear sometimes in our own human life, we overcompensate in friendship, don't we? We try and make the friend do things that we don't really have, okay? Give us some happiness. But it's completely different in the divine life with God. All the interiority of happiness, all the bliss, the beauty of it, comes from God. They receive no other interior aid to happiness than the eternity, truth, and charity of the Creator. But Augustine goes on, he says, but if they can be said to be helped from without, by friends, for example, perhaps it is only by this that they see one another and rejoice in God at their fellowship. They're part of this great communion. They're part of the city of God. Okay, the celestial, you know, realm. It is communal. Principally in God, for God, through God, we receive this happiness. But it's not inconsequential that we have friends, and our friends are there as external helps. We can rejoice with them. In what we share, in what we see, in what we're enjoying. And that's not, you know, any harm or anything, anyway, injurious to our happiness. Okay, I've probably gone on a long time, so I'm going to leave it at that. And Sinead, you can take over again.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.